As we read those words together from John's Gospel, chapter 19, I wonder who you identify with the most in this final act of the trial of Jesus, the cruel trial, the kangaroo court, the unreasonable, the unjust, the merciless trial. I want us to think this morning about Pilate, I want us to think about the Jews, and I want us to think about Jesus as we read this cruel conclusion to the trial as we head towards the crucifixion next week that we'll look at together. First of all, let's think about Pilate. He's finished the first round of the interrogation of Jesus, that conclusion statement in chapter 18 and verse 38. I find no basis for a charge against him. But the Jews are still crying, beginning of chapter 19, for his execution. So now he tries a different approach, verses 1 to 4. Maybe at this time he sent Jesus to Herod, and there was the events that we read about in some of the other Gospels, with him being dressed up as a king with Herod and sent back. And maybe that happened in a slightly different place in the sequence of events. But the conclusion, at least, is that Jesus is back, and they have him flogged and mocked and beaten with their fists. Meanwhile, it would seem Pilate's hiding in his residence. He seems to be inside his residence and then come out. And he comes out and he announces to the crowd, "Here is the man, behold." It's that word that John uses quite a bit. "Behold the man." Probably, trying to get into the Pilate's mind here, which is not easy, but probably he thought that either the Jews would be satisfied with this amount of scourging and flogging, or perhaps actually seeing Jesus ridiculed and mocked, they would feel sorry for him. So they're either satisfied enough has been done, or it's provoked sympathy in them. They realize that he's innocent, and they realize what a cruel thing they're doing. But either way, it doesn't work, does it? The Jews insist he deserves to die according to their law because he claimed to be the Son of God. And then we read that Pilate is even more afraid. So that must mean he was afraid already. Don't know what he was afraid of exactly, but he's even more afraid now. Maybe he was just afraid of the Jews. Maybe he was afraid of an uprising. Maybe he was afraid of some political instability that meant that he lost his job or even his life. But now he's even more afraid. And perhaps it's around about this time that he hears from his wife. Read about that in Matthew 27, verse 10. And his wife says, "I've been troubled by this man Jesus," about this man Jesus, "in a dream." And the Jews say that he needs to be crucified, he needs to be executed, because he claimed to be the Son of God. Now, of course, that's a big thing for the Jews, a big part of what they would claim to be the blasphemy of Jesus. But Pilate is part of an empire that worshipped many gods and recognized the existence of many gods. And that phrase, Son of God, would also have meant something to them, to him and to them. So I think probably he's afraid because he wonders, is there something special about Jesus? He's now beginning to fear Jesus a bit. He's afraid of Jesus. He wants to know more about Jesus. So that's where this question comes. Where are you from? I don't think he's thinking geographically, where were you born? But where did you come from? Did you just fall out of the sky? Are you from another planet? Are you one of the gods that we worship? Where did you come from? And he's exasperated because Jesus didn't answer. So verse 10, he says, "Don't you realize I've got power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus doesn't question Pilate's judicial power, but he says, "You're only here, you only have this power because this authority has been granted to you from above by God the Father. So it's not really your decision. You have power, but it's delegated power from God the Father." Perhaps Pilate's beginning to understand a little, so he's trying even harder now to set Jesus free. But the Jews are throwing every possible argument. They're throwing the political arguments. They're throwing the religious arguments. They're throwing that we have a law, we're able to govern our own affairs. For all these reasons, you should crucify him. The other Gospels tell us they threw in a few other ones about taxes. They make up a story, confusing some words Jesus said to say that Jesus isn't going to pay taxes, so he's really a rebel. So you could crucify him because of that, or he's threatening Caesar. And there's the implication, you're no friend of Caesar at the end, that really is we're going to dob you in to your rulers. If you don't crucify him, we're going to say you don't really like Caesar, you're not really a friend of Caesar's. So Pilate sits, ironically, on this judgment seat, this place where the verdict was going to be given. Makes a bit of an attempt to free Jesus, but he's really losing his grip, isn't he? He's losing his grip on the situation. He's losing his grip on justice. He's losing his grip on truth. And Jesus is handed over. He gives in to their request. It doesn't mean that he was handed over to the Jews entirely, but it means he was handed over to their request, to what they wanted. Of course, they get the Roman soldiers to actually do the execution, but he's giving Jesus up to them and allowing them to use the soldiers to crucify Jesus. Pilate knows that Jesus is innocent. Three times he makes that formal statement, "I find no basis for a charge against him." He has some sympathy for Jesus. He tries to get him released. He maybe thinks there's something special about Jesus. He's not sure what, but he knows there's something about him. Maybe there's something miraculous about Jesus. Maybe there's something divine about Jesus. Maybe there's something otherworldly about Jesus. Maybe there's something kingly about Jesus. But he holds back. He says he's innocent. He thinks he's special, but he holds back. Why does he hold back? He's a proud man in the end. He makes that statement, "Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" He thinks he's in charge. He thinks he is sitting in judgment on Jesus. He thinks he's the one with the power, even though he's got some problems. But of course he isn't. All power has come from God. And in fact, God is judging him. And history will judge him. But in his pride, he thinks it's all about my decision. So pride governs his actions. But the fear of men particularly seems to be driving him and stops him from doing what's obviously the right thing. He's trying to appease the people. He's trying to fix. He's trying to avoid confrontation. He's trying to protect himself. He's trying to do the right thing, but he's not prepared to pay the cost for doing the right thing because he fears people too much. And ultimately, he doesn't really want Jesus in his life, does he? He doesn't particularly want Jesus killed, but he wants Jesus out of his life. He wants Jesus not to be a problem to him. He wants Jesus not to be bothering him. He wants Jesus to go away. You're a bit like Pilate. Maybe you have sympathy for Jesus. Maybe you will look with us at the crucifixion story, and you will feel a great sense of sympathy for Jesus. This man who's punished so cruelly. This man who is so loving. You have a sympathy for Jesus. But Pilate shows us that sympathy is not enough. Maybe you think pretty highly of Jesus. You don't hate Jesus this morning. You probably think Jesus is something special. You don't particularly want to condemn Jesus this morning. But like Pilate in your pride, you're thinking, but it's up for me to decide. It's my choice. I have the power to either choose you, Jesus, or to reject you. It's just my choice. It's something I can do. And it's something I do independent of God. I sit over God and say, do I fancy believing in him or not? I might do today, might not tomorrow. And Pilate says to us, our very breath, our very life, our very opportunity comes from God. And he sits over us. And we just have to humbly bow and say, you are the king, and I need to start trusting you. In his pride, Pilate sits on the judgment seat, that stone seat. He's sitting, he's giving the verdict. But we are giving a verdict on Pilate because God is giving a verdict on Pilate. We know the verdict on Jesus. He's an innocent man. That's not the question. The question is, what's the verdict on Pilate? And the question this morning is, what's the verdict on you? Are you someone who thinks quite highly of Jesus, but you're not prepared to cross over and to pay the cost because of the fear of men? For most of you, maybe for all of you, if you start trusting Jesus, it's not going to cause a riot, is it? But it might disrupt your life in some way. Your friends at school or your friends at work might notice the changes. Maybe your family will be divided because of it. Maybe you'll be ridiculed just like Jesus was. Maybe life just gets more complicated if you really start following Jesus. So in your pride or in your fear of men, you're not prepared to humble yourself and to say, I'm prepared to pay the cost because Jesus, you're worth it. And Pilate stands as this lesson to us because Pilate ends up as a loser, doesn't he? History records him as a weak, fundamentally unjust man who knew better. He wants to wash his hands. He wants to publicly disconnect himself. He wants to just like Jesus. But in the end, by sitting in judgment over Jesus, he's condemned himself. And you know what? In the end, if you sit in judgment over Jesus, you're condemned yourself. You see, the person of Jesus, the innocence of Jesus, is not in question, and it's not for you to judge. The question is, what do you make of Jesus? Will you trust him? Will you follow him? Will you love him? Will you look up to him? Will you humble yourself before him? Are you prepared to pay the cost of following Jesus? Let's think about the Jews. Sometimes we have the Jews used as the word to describe the people, sometimes the chief priests and their officials. I guess that's to conjure up the idea that you've got some leaders, the chief priests and their officials, kind of leading the crowd, egging the crowd on, and then you've got kind of the mass of the crowd that's there, the Jewish crowd. Their opposition, their hatred of Jesus, it's total, isn't it? It's unrelenting. They're so headlong in their hatred that they're even happy to play political games with Roman governors. They don't even think the Romans should be there. In their best moments, they don't think Caesar should be the king over them. But they're happy to play the game and to make the arguments in a way that Pilate will understand. There's a man who's been declared innocent 3 times. Even in their own trial, they've broken their own rules about how someone should be tried. But we just see them cry with this poisonous anger. Crucify, crucify. You get the idea with John putting it in there twice, that maybe it becomes a chant. You can just imagine the chief priests going, crucify, crucify, and the crowd joining, crucify, crucify. They're shouting for Jesus to be crucified. And then they make this extraordinary statement in verse 15. We have no king but Caesar, the chief priest said. Of course, they're using it as a political statement to try and get around Pilate, to make another argument to him. He said, this is the king of the Jews. But really, they're kind of exposing their hearts at the same time. We have no king. We don't want this king to rule over us. Luke records a parable of the 10 miners, 10 amounts of money. There's a prince who goes away and he's going to be made king. And he's made king and he's given some money as he's gone away and then he comes back. So this prince comes back as king. And when he comes back, the people in this parable say, "We don't want this man to rule over us." And that's just what the Jews are saying here. We don't want this man, Jesus, to rule over us. And we so don't want him, we're going to kill him. We're going to make it seem just. We're going to get you to help us. But we're going to kill him because we don't want him to be our king. And they should have known better. That's what Jesus means in verse 11, second half. "The one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." He's talking perhaps especially about Caiaphas, the high priest, who handed Jesus over to Pilate. But of course, the one could be extended to the Jews. The Jews should know better. You, Pilate, have some responsibility because you have the authority to judge justly, but they have an even greater responsibility, the Jews, because they should know so much more, not just about justice, but about prophecy, about God's saving plans. They should know better, so they're guilty of an even greater sin. Pilate had power, but he's on catch-up. But Caiaphas in particular and the Jews in general bear that greater responsibility. They've seen all the signs. John's recorded them for us and the other gospel writers too. Signs that should show them that Jesus is the promised Messiah. And they're ignoring them. And they don't want him to be king. Perhaps some of you here are in an even worse state than Pilate. Perhaps you see the signs of Jesus' work in Scripture. Perhaps you've been here for a few weeks and you've looked together with us as we've gone through John's Gospel. You've seen the signs about Jesus. You've seen Jesus work in the lives of your friends. You've seen people change. You've heard testimony of God's work in their lives. But still you want to get rid of Jesus. You don't want him to be your king. Perhaps you even lie to yourselves about how terrible Jesus is, or how terrible Jesus' rule is, or how much you kind of like Jesus in general, but you don't want him to actually be in charge of your life. There are so many things in the Bible that you don't really believe or want to follow. You don't want him to rule over you. You want to get rid of him. Some of you here have been to this church quite a lot. Some of you have been brought up in Christian homes or have been brought, along to here quite often. You're in a way in the same category of the Jew, as the Jews were. You've heard a lot. You've seen a lot. You've experienced a lot. And if this morning you're saying about Jesus, "Do away with him, I don't want him to be my king," then you're as responsible as the Jews are. You're standing in front of Jesus and saying, "Crucify him." In effect, that's what you're saying. If you reject Jesus, if you say, "I don't want Jesus to be my king," you're saying, "Crucify him. Get rid of him. Get him out of my face." And some of you need to think of all that you've seen and all that you know and all that you've heard and think, this is the time to stop being like the Jews. Stop trying to get rid of Jesus. Stop trying to make our own way to God. Perhaps you have friends who are like that. They respond angrily, trying to get rid of Jesus from their lives. Angry because of the demands Jesus makes on our lifestyle. But don't want him to be king. Don't be like the Jews. Let's look last of all at Jesus himself. He's flogged. And if you read descriptions of a Roman flogging, he was maybe flogged here, maybe flogged later as well. It's brutal. It rips the flesh away. He has a crown of thorns placed on his head, mocking, but also hurting and cutting him. The soldiers, perhaps one after the other, walk up to him, say, "Hail, King of the Jews," and thump him in the face. but he doesn't retaliate. And then he's brought out and he stands there in front of the Jews, perhaps by now blood running down his face, blood running down his back. And his own people cry with this hatred, crucify him. We're compelled to look at him in wonder, aren't we? This silent dignity, this willing humility. It's amazing, particularly that striking. It's amazing that Jesus allows that to happen, isn't it? That a soldier who compared to God, is nothing, walks up and strikes the Son of God on the face, the maker of the universe, the agent of creation, the one who holds the stars in his hands, is struck on the face by just some random soldier, and he lets it happen. We look in awe and we look in wonder. But John wants us to see more about Jesus. And we see that particularly in verse 14, second half of verse 14. John uses the words of Pilate, where Pilate says, "Here is your king." And again, it's a word that John likes to use, the word that we sometimes translate, "Behold your king." And John, I think, wants us to hear Pilate's words, where Pilate puts Jesus in front of the Jews, and he wants to hear it for ourselves. He wants us to hear Pilate saying, "Take a good look at this man, because he's your king. Take a good look at this man who's been beaten, who has been flogged, who has been mocked, who is cruelly treated. Take a good look at this man and know for yourself that Jesus is the king." That mock kingly outfit, the purple robe, the crown of thorns, the scepter that he's given in his hand to kind of show his kingly reign as a joke. In the end, it's a joke on the people, isn't it? Because he really is the king. And Pilate has it absolutely right. Behold, take a good look at your king. But also, John wants us to see, behold the Lamb. Take a good look and see that he's not just the king, but he's also the sacrifice. You see, verse 14, the first part of it says this. It was the day of preparation of Passover week, about the sixth hour. John's not just telling us the time. Really, the time's irrelevant. Doesn't really need to tell us the day, because we could probably work that out from the sequence of events. What he's saying is, there's something significant about this day. This is the day we prepare the Passover lamb. The Passover, that feast celebrated by the Jews to commemorate their exit from Egypt due to the angel coming and destroying the firstborn of Egypt, but passing by all the houses of those who had the blood daubed over their tents, their doorposts. And what John wants us to see, not only is Jesus the king, but he's the Passover lamb. He keeps mentioning the Passover through this section because of that. Jesus is the perfect Passover lamb, and see him as that this morning. The reason he's taking all this mocking and spitting and flogging and beating, the reason he's taking it all, the reason he's enduring it all, is not just to show how humble he can be. It's not just to demonstrate humility. It's not just to be a picture of injustice. It's actually and practically to be a sacrifice for us. He has a crown of thorns on his head. And of course, that's a mockery of his kingship. But just think about thorns for a minute. What's the significance of thorns in the Bible? Thorns are there at the curse, aren't they? When Adam and Eve fall and disobey God and want to get rid of his rule, there's thorns. They're a kind of picture of the fall, of the earth being disrupted. And Jesus has a picture, not just of kingship, but he has a picture of the curse on his head. He wears the thorns because he's going to wear the curse. He's going to take the curse on himself. That's Jesus. And of course, the fourth character here is John writing. And he's shown as Pilate, superstitious, fearful of men, proud. And he's shown us the Jews who hate Jesus and want to get rid of him. And he's shown us Jesus, the King, the Lamb. And of course, what John is saying as he writes these words and as he finishes off his book, John writing is saying, this is my position on this. I believe, and I want you to believe too. I want you to observe this scene. I want you to read this, and I want you to see for yourself that Jesus is King and that Jesus is sacrifice. Don't hate him. Don't try and get rid of him. But also, don't just like him a bit. I was fascinated. Yesterday, there was that serious illness of a player, a Bolton football player in the Premiership, collapsed during a game for no apparent reason in terms of injury or anything else, and is now seriously ill. I don't know what the news is on him today. But what was fascinating was all the people who were tweeting, all the footballers who were tweeting, that they're praying for him. Now, I can't judge every single one of them, but en masse, who were they praying to? What were they on about? They're just like Pilate, superstitious, but they don't want Jesus to rule over their lives. They're not looking up and saying, I'm praying that Jesus, the King of all the earth, will be merciful in this situation. And John wants us to not be superstitious and not to reject Jesus and not to be proud and not to fear men, but to be like him and to see the King and to see the Lamb. He knows it's going to be costly. Pilate wasn't prepared to pay the cost. Jesus was. The true followers of Jesus were. Of course, Jesus is going through this to be a sacrifice, but he at the same time is going through this as a pattern, isn't he? He's a pattern for us of how we will suffer, how we will sometimes be rejected and mocked, and sometimes in some places even physically beaten and wounded. So he wants us to see Jesus as a pattern, but he fundamentally wants us to see Jesus as a king and as a sacrifice. We're going to sing together, Come and See, as an encouragement to each other to really take a good look at Jesus. Come and see, the King of Love. See the purple robe and crown of thorns he wears. Soldiers mock, rulers sneer as he lifts the cruel cross. Lone and friendless now, he climbs towards the hill. And I want to really encourage you to be a person who can sing that chorus with great meaning and personal commitment. We worship at your feet where wrath and mercy meet and a guilty world is washed by love's pure stream. To say that, Jesus, you're taking my sin there, you're my King and you're my sacrifice, and I worship you this morning. And we're going to remain standing. And then I'm going to pray briefly, and then we're going to go into our closing hymn, which is, And Can It Be That I Should Gain? Could it be that I put my faith in this man and live to trust him and will never be condemned?